Okay, well, the history of the anarchist movement spans some of the most exciting social struggles over the last 160 years. It includes their participation in the life of the First International. It includes substantial revolutionary organisations, the Industrial Workers of the World that was built in Europe, in America, and in this country during the anti-war struggles against the First World War. It includes their response to the Russian Revolution. At an absolute high point of their influence, it includes the Spanish Civil War or Revolution. And, of course, anarchists have been influential in the last wave of radicalisation in the 60s and 70s, and we encounter them today in our own campaigns, and in particular in the anti-capitalist movement at the beginning of the 21st century. However, if the organisers of this conference had been a bit more honest in the titling of this talk, I think they probably should have called it A Potted History of Anarchism, because unfortunately that is all that time will permit me to go through. But that's the thing about time, it's very authoritarian, so I am bound by it, unfortunately. Now, what I want to do is critically evaluate some of the most influential anarchists, from Proudhon, because he was the founder of anarchism, Bakunin and Emma Goldman, who remain influential today. And I want to particularly look at the role of the anarchists in Spain. Now, throughout my analysis, what I'm going to assume is that as a Marxist, from my point of view, and in critiquing the anarchists, I'm going to assume that we share an opposition to capitalism, that anarchism, most anarchists are anti-capitalist, and this might come as a revelation for some people influenced by anarchism, but I'd also argue that Marxism is also opposed to state authority, that Lenin talked about the withering away of the state. However, our view of the state is one that's informed by a class analysis of the state, and that the key difference actually lies in how we get to a classless society and whether the workers' state is a necessary step on that road. And that, I think, is what Spain is really all about. And I'm going to evaluate in a critical way because I think we again stand on the precipice of another very exciting time for our side, for those who are struggling to get rid of this system. And it's going to be a time that, therefore, the ideas that different political currents have to offer will once again be tested in their value that they offer those who are struggling alongside us to get rid of capitalism. Okay, so now you know what you're in for. Stay now or leave now or forever hold your peace and we'll get started. Now, I'm starting with Proudhon because he was the first theorist to call himself an anarchist. He is most famous for the statement, property is theft. You may have come across that in your political courses at university, or you may have just looked him up on Wikipedia and you'll find it there as well. And what he's referring to is the way that the landlords use their ownership over the land to exploit the peasants through rent. And he's also referring to the way that the capitalists exploit workers through their ownership of the means of production. And so he does attack the exploitative basis of property ownership under capitalism. The alternative that he advocates for is a system that he terms mutualism. Now, this is a system of small, autonomous producers freely exchanging the products of their labour. It's not a system that's opposed to individual ownership of property. And here he has in mind the artisans' ownership over their tools and the peasants' ownership over the land. For bigger workplaces, he is for workers running them cooperatively for some form of workers' control. However, he is against the socialisation of property. He's against bringing it under broad democratic control of the organs of workers' democracy. Instead, he argues that through the flourishing of free trade, unfettered by monopolies and big, really big business, that competition will allow for products to be exchanged at a fair price. These ideas have a lot in common with neoliberalism today. The idea that free trade will best be able to determine the real value of goods, sort of supply and demand economics. And in order to get to this society, Proudhon's key project was about establishing a mutual credit society. So it's basically banking reform. He saw that that the capitalist should be taxed, wanted to impose a form of income tax, if you like, and then use that as the basis of providing cheap credit to get new productive enterprise off the ground. But like most schemes that involve the goodwill of the capitalist class, it was stillborn and never got off the ground. Now, Proudhon thought that you could have a peaceful transition to a mutualist society. He thought that the state and that capital would simply be enveloped as mutualism took off. And therefore, he rejected the necessity of the class struggle as being absolutely vital to actually expropriate, to actually take back the wealth of the capitalist class. Instead, he implored workers, this quote comes from April of 1848, he said, "Workers, hold out your hands to your employers, and employers, do not repudiate the advances of those workers who have worked for you." So in other words, ask nicely, ask really nicely. And while he recognised the high ideal of the right of economic competition as a right per se, he rejected any right to combination, that is a right to join unions for the working class, as being anti-democratic and anti-economic. He would again and again identify with the plight of those who were under siege by the working class, whether it was in strikes or whether it was in the revolutions of 1848. He likened the soldiers who opened fire and killed striking miners to the father figure of Brutus, who had to kill his own son in order to maintain the social order. It gets worse. In the revolution of 1848, he said, "I fled before the democratic and social monster whose riddle I could not answer. An inexpressible terror froze my soul, and I wept for the burgesses." But at least he's honest. He acknowledges that it is the democratic nature of the movement, and he acknowledges that he has no answers. And if more anarchists would acknowledge that, then that would be good. Before we move off Proudhon, I have to note that as with his follower, Bakunin, who I'm just about to skip onto, he was a raving anti-Semite and a misogynist. He, as a direct quote, thought that women had acquired all they needed to know once they had learnt how to cook a steak and mend a shirt. So if there are any Proudhonists out there, you can pretty much discount anything I've got to say because I've mastered neither of those things. Okay. So if we turn, though, to Bakunin, Bakunin was the first to organise others under the banner of anarchism. He drew his ideas from Proudhon, from Stirner, and to some extent from Marx. He sort of had a grab bag from different theorists. If we want to take a bit of a look at his politics, we can look at the Revolutionary Catechism that he wrote in 1866. First thing to say about that is it's a catechism. So for him, revolutionary politics is a set of articles of faith as opposed to a scientific theory for social change. However, perhaps that's just a particular way he titled it. But he doesn't seem to have any sense of irony that the first two points of the Revolutionary Catechism, pertain to the influence of God and religion. I think it's interesting as well how you position your hit list. That number one, we've got God and religion. You have to get to point number 9D before you get to any mention of the abolition of classes. So where Marx starts the Communist Manifesto with the class struggle, we have to read quite a distance before there's any such mention, and no mention of class struggle, I might add, but of the abolition of classes. And I think that this obscures the enemy. I think he does this explicitly when he goes on to say, point 9e, that the state is the permanent cause. Thank you. The state is the permanent cause of all brutalisation and the degradation of the multitude. Now, I would contend that it's the capitalist control of the means of production that enables them to exploit people that is the source, the real source of oppression and exploitation under capitalism. But to do that, the capitalists require a system of laws and the army and the police force and ideological institutions to maintain the status quo, to maintain that state of affairs, and therein lies the role of the state. And so it's important to analyse the state from the starting point of whose interests, whose class interests does it serve. Whereas for Bakunin, his view of the state is a classless anti-authoritarianism. I think there's two problems that flow from that. One is a tendency to abstain from political questions. For Bakunin, he never took up the national question, which was vital in colonial France. He, like most anarchists that followed, opposed any form of parliamentary elections. But other things that you might not think of, he and Emma Goldman both abstained from the question of the length of the working day, so the fight for the 8-hour day, and in Goldman's case, abstained from the question of women's suffrage, for example. So there's that tendency to abstain from political questions, but there is also, as I mentioned in the introduction, an opposition to the workers' state. As for anarchists, the state in whatever form is the root of all evil. Okay, so the alternative that Bakunin was for a federated system of autonomous communes. However, to do that, he envisioned a federated parliament, and at other points he described that this parliament would need a public force. He talked about how people it would be mandatory for people to carry out physical labour in order to gain their subsistence. So really it amounts to a state by any other name. But what I think is even more corrosive was that he envisioned a secret minority pulling the strings from behind a curtain. He wrote to one of his collaborators that in the midst of anarchy, what would be required was revolutionary unity, and the force to achieve such unity and discipline would be the Secret International Brothers. That was the name of his organisation. So the real instigators of the revolution are an elite minority, while the masses are passively manipulated. This sort of politics led to the political practice of supporting putschers. Now, Bakunin's wasn't involved in very many social struggles. His own political interest only intensified for about 10 years of his life. But in that time, he was involved in two putschers. The first was in Lyon in 1870. It followed out of there'd been demonstrations in Lyon involving several thousand people, and he argued to his followers that this would be an opportunity to establish the anarchist commune. However, his own organisation rejected that, but not to be deterred by a democratic vote, Bakunin took 20 of his loyal followers to Lyon and marched into the town hall and declared the abolition of the state. If only it was so easy, I too would be an anarchist. However, it turned out that the soldiers hadn't heard that their role had actually didn't exist anymore, and they proceeded to arrest Bakunin, and actually and out of that he was taken out of, you know, the very next year, the Paris Commune, the struggles in the Paris Commune. Thank you. He participated in a similar farce in Bologna a few years later in 1874. But I think it's also interesting to note the secretive nature of the International Alliance, or Internationalist Alliance, that was Bakunin's organisation. And it reflected, actually, the needs of a conspiratorial struggle. He wrote to Nechayev, one of his collaborators, that he wrote, "By what force shall we direct the people's revolution?" He answered himself, "An invisible force, recognised by no one, imposed by no one, our own collective dictatorship, the collective dictatorship of our organisation will be all the mightier the more it is invisible, unofficial, and not legal." Now, this is anathema to socialist organisation. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx talks about the task for socialists is to openly proclaim socialism, to try to influence the people around them in an open fight over the political questions of the day. For us, carrying out actions is only possible because of the conviction of the majority of participants in those actions. What Bakunin's model of organisation really reflects is the worst caricatures that anarchists make about the vanguard party. Actually, it's Bakunin's organisation that was separate to the working class as a whole. It involved the manipulation by an elite of the mass of people, and it was highly centralised as well. All decisions required approval from the national leadership. And there was layers to Bakunin's organisation. So there was the public front of the organisation, but then there was secret leaderships, if you like, who were really in control. And behind that, there were three dictators who, unelected by anyone in the organisation, were really running the show. Charles Peron, who was one of those who was asked to be a dictator by Bakunin, he didn't call himself a dictator, but describes the process of sort of being asked to join, you know, the Internationalist Alliance. A few days later, "Oh well, we need something more central. So perhaps he should join the International Brotherhood." And then some weeks after that, he was asked to, he was told, as he was asked, about the existence of these three positions in the party. So it is a real inversion of the history of the debate between Bakunin and Marx in the First International that it is presented that Bakunin is the libertarian and Marx is the authoritarian. However, if you repeat the word Marx's name and authoritarianism enough times, it suffices to be true for many of the anarchist commentators on this. But actually, after Bakunin's unsuccessful bid to take over the Peace League, he then applied for his organisation to join the First International. But he demanded that they would not be subject to the very minimal authority of the General Council. He wanted complete authority, especially for their branch. This was rejected, so he simply dropped that from their program, but he never actually dropped the practice. He talked about wanting to, at first, his project was to try to take over the First International. He talked to his secretly, and these documents weren't available at the time that the splits debate between Bakunin and Marx was taking place. But subsequently, it's emerged that he talked about how against their enemies they should resort to lies, slander, dirty tricks, and this is very much the political practice that he carried out in his battle with Marx. In a letter to Herzen, he talked openly of the need to split the International. He said, "Don't you see that all these gentlemen who are our enemies form a phalanx which it is essential to disunite and split in order to be able to rout them more easily?" So, and Bakunin actually wanted to leave. However, he was convinced to stay and be forced to force Marx and the General Council to expel him, because that would enable them to bring more people out of the International. Okay, if we move on to Emma Goldman, I want to talk about her because she's probably one of the most romanticised of the anarchist figures. Thanks. She got involved in politics at the age of 17 in response to the hanging of the Haymarket Martyrs, and she quickly became one of the most popular anarchist speakers in America. Like most anarchists, she was drawn to individualistic political acts as a substitute for mass action. In a pamphlet called Minorities and Majorities, she wrote, "Always, at every period, the few were the banner bearers of a great idea of a liberating effort. Not so the mass, the leaden weight of which does not let it move." And she went on to express what I think is utter contempt for ordinary people. She said, "The majority cares little for ideals or integrity. What it craves is a display. It matters not whether that be a dog show, a prize fight, or a lynching." So in other words, the enlightened elite carry out revolutionary heroic acts while the rest of us just watch Australian Idol. The most extreme conclusion from this outlook is to flirt with terrorism, and Goldman was involved with this. During a steel strike in 1892, in response to soldiers opening fire and killing seven workers, her and her collaborators devised a scheme to shoot the CEO of the steel company. However, it ended in disaster. Hugh O'Donnell, one of the leaders of the strike, describes it like this. He said, "It would seem that the bullet from Berkman's pistol," Berkman was her partner who carried out the assassination attempt, "it would seem that the bullet from his pistol, failing in its foul intent, went through the heart of the Homestead strike instead. It was demoralising, and Berkman himself went to jail for 14 years. Emma's role in this, Goldman's role rather, was to popularise and explain why they had done what they did, although later she would renounce those tactics. The other major event in American labour history that she was connected to was the formation of the Social Democratic Party, which brought together circles of socialists and others, and was a real step forward because it very importantly involved breaking from the capitalist parties that were on offer. However, she was engaged by one faction as an advisor. That faction, the Utopians, argued against any form of political action, and they would go on to split the Social Democratic Party and wreck that project. Goldman remained critical of the Socialist Party that formed out of that split. However, and she was right to be critical. A lot of them became more conservative. They expelled anybody that was for direct action in 1912, for example. But her opposition to any form of campaigning in Parliament was based not so much on the nature of Parliament, but again, a contempt for ordinary people. She said, "The problem is, politicians stoop to the level of the electorate, catering to every superstition, every prejudice, every silly tradition." For many years, she withdrew from politics. For a good portion of her life, she edited Mother Jones, and that's what a lot of the people that want to romanticise her go on about. But in fact, it was largely cultural criticism. So I don't want to deal with that. I want to say briefly, though, how she responded to the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution, thanks. The Russian Revolution inspired socialists, anarchists even, syndicalists, all different political currents around the world. And many anarchists actually in Russia went over to support the Bolsheviks. Viktor Serge was probably the most prominent of them. Goldman herself welcomed initially the revolution, and she travelled to Russia to see what it was all about. However, she quickly became disillusioned, and in particular, she condemned the new economic policy. She condemned Kronstadt, and we can have debates about those things, you know, in the discussion. But what I would say is that she never accepted the Bolsheviks' explanation that the isolation of the Russian Revolution was imposing these measures upon them, and was strangling the revolution from the outside. And yet she would use these same explanations to justify the actions of the CNT in Spain, which she later became an international spokesperson of. Her partner, Emil Berkman, however, was more honest when he was in private. In his own diaries, in response to Viktor Serge's criticism that the anarchists had nothing but criticism for the regime but could offer no alternative, Berkman wrote that many vital problems could find no adequate answer in our books and our theories. Our opposition to the dictatorship of the proletariat, do we have anything to offer in its place? And I'd say that the Spanish Civil War really puts that to the test, because many of the most political and militant workers were part of the CNT, which was the Anarchist Union, and or the FAI, their political party. Their strategy, though, was syndicalism, and it differed in some ways to some of the anarchists that I've touched on so far. It differed in that its orientation was to the mass of the working class as being key to social change and to utilise their industrial power. And they were for workers' control. But their link with anarchism was their attitude to the workers' state. They were opposed to the workers taking state power. And to some extent, they were the nature of their party as well, in that the FAI and CNT were a loosely federated organisation with autonomy for all of the local sections. Very briefly, in terms of some way of background to the role they played in the revolution, the military rose in Spain on July 17 against the Popular Front government, and it was a culmination of the class polarisation that had taken place throughout the 1930s. Everyone, when the Popular Front government again was returned to power in 1936, expected that there would be a confrontation, because despite the best efforts of the Popular Front government to be moderate, the expectations of workers had been raised to an all-time high, and people expected real change. And so when the military did finally rise, the workers in many places were ready, they confronted them, they defeated in many places the military rising and disarmed, you know, the soldiers who'd been a part of it. But where the Popular Front government hesitated, where people listened to their officials, the military rising was successful. And so you have Spain cleft in two, if you like, between the fascists behind one side of the barricades, and behind the other you have the Republican government, the moderate Republican government, but you also have what's emerging democratic institutions born out of the land and factory collectivisation that was taking place, that was necessary in order to supply the militias who were fighting the fascists at the front. And so you have the beginnings of a transformation of society happening behind the lines of the Republican barricades. Now, the CNT threw itself enthusiastically into that social experiment. However, it also brought out some of the weaknesses of their organisation. Because while it might sound as though the people at the grassroots will have more control, more be able to have more initiative, than the centralized party that is often misrepresented as being the socialist model of a party. In fact, it became a problem when they wanted to organize more beyond just local actions, let alone form a national cohesive strategy. Thank you. What it required, as Cesar Lorenzo, the son of the national secretary of the CNT, was that for militants to get their decisions accepted, they had to exhaust themselves making speeches, personal contacts, moving from place to place. And among the libertarians, the ballot was repugnant. The unanimity that they sought required interminable debate. And so actually it enabled the people with more resources, people from more middle-class backgrounds, to rise to the ranks of the leadership of the CNT-FAI, rather than the other way around. However, the key test was around the question of how to take the revolution forward. And this question was a question of whose legitimacy should be recognised, because you have a situation where the Republican government represent parliamentary democracy and the unequal society of the Spain pre-1936, and the local committees on the other side representing the new Spain that many of the workers and peasants were fighting for. Both organs of democracy represent social systems that are diametrically opposed to one another and could not coexist indefinitely. On the question of whose power was to be paramount, I think where the anarchists lined up is best shown through what happened in Catalonia. A few days after the military rising, where the anarchists were particularly strong in Catalonia, Lluís Companys of the Popular Front government called three of the anarchist leaders to his office, and he said to them, "You control the street. Tell me now if you would like me to resign." And the anarchists were fairly shocked by this, fair enough. and they took the debate back to the CNT-FAI. However, it was resolved unanimously in the end that to take power would be a betrayal of the anarchist principles. However, to choose not to, the corollary of that choice was to maintain the legitimacy of the Republican government. And that meant strangling the fight against fascism, because it was plagued by their hesitation. They were more fearful of the initiative of the working class being turned against them than they were against the fascists. And so only by confronting their power and replacing it with their own organs of democracy could they absolutely dismantle the power of the Republican government. And in the end, they had to collaborate. Having missed the opportunity to take power in their own right, they later entered government in Catalonia only a few months later in September, and nationally they took four seats in the Popular Front government. The health minister, who was a CNT member, described the way that in doing so, they actually helped to legitimise the power and rule of the Republican government. They gave it a left face. They were, as he said, trapped in a vicious circle. This meant that they were utterly disarmed when the Republican government and the Communist Party moved to disarm the PUM and the CNT-FAI. The confrontation came when they attacked the Telegraph office in Barcelona, which had been a symbol of the revolution. The Communist Party came and expected that they would just be able to arrest the anarchists that were holding it. However, they met them with guns, and rightly so. The workers defended and drove back the communists for 5 days, and they were supported in this by the majority of the population in Catalonia. However, although many of the militias at the front wanted to come back to Barcelona to defend their comrades, the anarchist leaders argued against it. They said we have to continue to fight at the front. Durruti, who was one of the anarchist dissidents who did argue for taking power, had 500 men just on the border outside of Barcelona. However, Oliveira, one of the anarchist ministers in government, argued that he could not march any further and support them. In fact, it was the anarchist ministers of government that announced over the radio for the anarchists to lay down their arms, even though they were being fired upon by rifle fires, that they had to give up fighting. And although they resisted it, many shot their radios when they heard these announcements. When they were isolated after days, they needed to retreat. And that is the tragedy of the role of the anarchists in Spain. I'm not saying that they were the only reason that the Spanish Revolution were defeated. Far from it. This is not a talk about the role of the Stalinists, for example. However, I do think that the denial of the political question of the of state power led to them vacillating between an extreme militancy and collaboration, not in spite of their anarchist politics, but because of it. So to conclude, I think that the appeal of anarchism today is largely a negative one. It's because communism has been discredited in many people's eyes. There is a lack of understanding about the real causes of the defeat of the Russian Revolution, and instead people take from Bakunin's ideas, for example, a justification or an explanation for the rise of the bureaucracy in Russia. They also see the communist parties of old as seeming to confirm that, you know, the theory that advocates building a party is authoritarian. And so I think much of the anarchist appeal is actually that it seems more radical because of the model of communism of the past. I think it's also because of the decline of working class combativity over the last 30 years that theories like The Multitude of Tony Negri have become more in vogue. However, I think the period that we are going into will show again that it was premature to write off the role of the working class. In the coming struggles, we will need to do more than attack just the symbols of capitalist domination and power. We will need to look to the working class as the only social force with the strength to attack the very basis and root of the capitalist system. And that, I think, is where Marxism has more to offer than the faux radicalism of anarchism. Thank you.